Well, Peter, it's a pleasure to be here this afternoon and to have you participating in this Voices of the Grain Trade project. Perhaps we can start by my asking you to give your name and then to describe how you came to work in the grain industry. And it may take a little while getting to that, actually, but let's get started.
Okay, my name is Peter Barr. I worked for Saskatchewan Wheat Pool for 18 years. I started there in the late 70s. I applied for the job through the News Chronicle. I was living in southern Ontario. I wanted to come back to Thunder Bay or Port Arthur. I didn't think I'd get the job because I didn't know anybody. And in the grain business, you have to know somebody. But anyways, I applied for the job, and I got a phone call and talked to the person in charge and in that department, and he said, "Well, come on up for an interview." So I got on an airplane and flew up. It was Easter weekend, and my wife came with me, and we visited family while we were here. But anyways, I went for this interview, and he had some in their neighborhood of 20 pages of foolscap with questions on it. It took 4.5 hours to do the interview, and I thought, I'll never get through this. But anyways, I got through it, and we talked and talked and talked, and he asked me a lot of questions that I'd never been asked before. And I've had lots of interviews, but I was never asked these questions. I thought, oh, well, that's what he wants, that's what I'll tell him. Keith Broder was the man who interviewed me. He was an engineer with the company, and he was interested that I didn't know anybody because there had been so much foolishness down in this job, in the purchasing job, that too many friends and too many just too many things were going on. He said, "You don't know any." I knew one fella, and I wouldn't mention his name because he was a real character, and I didn't. I thought that would really screw me up. So, anyways, long story short, he made me an offer. He phoned me back about a week later and offered me the job, and we discussed it some more, and so I gave notice in Orangeville, and 3 4 weeks 3 weeks later I was 4 weeks later I was on my way back to Port Arthur, and I had to wait. I had to leave Eleanor and our two boys there because they were still in school. So anyways, I came back up by myself, and I lived at the Prince Arthur for 8 or 9 weeks. And the company, they understood that. They paid all my expenses at the Prince Arthur, and there was no problem. And Sask Pool at that time was a great company to work for.
Well, maybe before we pursue that, let's go back on with a couple of questions. So you started work there then, and this will sound like about April or May of.
Was in May, no, April,
of
April 1979.
1979, so
Right.
And 18 years then takes it to 97, so
Yeah.
you worked through the 80s and most of the 90s.
Yeah.
You made a reference to family and friends up here as well. Well, you were born in Port Arthur.
Yeah, I grew up
You
here.
grew up in the Lakehead.
Yeah.
And so there were people you knew here, your church,
Right.
St. Paul's United, I suppose,
Yes.
and so you knew people
I
through
knew
that.
people through that, and I knew people I grew up with, the
Yeah,
kids I went
in the
to school.
community.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it was just like, but it's surprising, the 2.5 years I was away, how things had changed. Some of my friends had moved away or died or something, and you don't realize these things happen in such a short time.
No, that is surprising.
Yeah.
Could you sketch very quickly what you had done then from the time that you finished high school and developed your career preparatory to working for Sask Pool?
I worked in supplies. I worked in purchasing. I worked in sales. I worked for Abitibi Woodlands for 7 years, in the office and in the supply department. I sold for a number of years different things.
What, manufacturers reps? Or?
Yeah, and local reps,
and
too.
Local reps.
And I traveled from here to White River every 3 weeks.
What, to bush camps? Or?
Well, to garages, bush camps, mm-hmm. everything. I sold mm-hmm. automotive parts.
Oh, yes.
But I was always in some kind of a supply end of it. Mm-hmm. And so I, when I worked at General Hospital, and I was a head storekeeper there. Mm-hmm. And I was a purchasing agent in a hospital in Orangeville.
And that's what took you down there? You applied for a job down there?
Yeah. I couldn't wait here for the purchasing agent here. I couldn't wait for him to leave, so I had to leave. And then when I came back, I was here about 6 months, and he retired. Art Hartvigsen phoned me up and said, "Are you interested in coming back?" Well, by then I had been with Sass Pool for 6 months, and they had treated me so well. They had moved me back, and they were a good company. And mm-hmm. I said, "No, Art, I'm not. That wouldn't be fair to them." So right. I stayed with Sass Pool.
Well, you might then, you were on the brink of expanding on what the company was like, and now you're saying something about that.
Well, in those days, it changed while I was there. A number of 10 or 12 years later, we had the
early
shake-up and new people in there. But when I went there, they were an excellent company. They mm-hmm. were fair. They were honest. In fact, I was instructed that... we don't want to put any supplier out of business. Don't go so hard that you somebody's going to lose money on something. In fact, I had times when, I'll give you one example, I put a quote out, and we were getting something made, and I bought a lot of steel in those days, because we bought tons of steel. Every fall I would buy 30 to 40 tons of steel. And I knew the price of steel, and this guy quoted this job, and he didn't have enough money in it to pay for the steel, let alone the work and the painting and what had to be done. So I phoned him up, and he was a good supplier. And I phoned him, I said, "Bob, are you sure your price is right?" "Oh, yes." He said, "Well, I'll check it." He said, he phoned me back. "Oh, that's the price." And I said, "Well, you got the order, buddy." I said, "I think you're wrong, but you got the order." And he said, "No, I'm right." I said, "Okay, that's fine." So he supplied it, and about 2 or 3 weeks later, he's in my office. "Oh," he said, "I should have listened to you," he said. And I said, "Why?" He said, "I didn't even cover my material." So, and I had the authority then that I could change things. And I said, "Okay, Bob. Give me what's your cost on this?" He told me, and I said, "Okay, and what's your markup usually?" And he told me, and I said, "Okay, I'll change the order. I'm only going to do this once." I said, "I'll change the order and give you what you should have got." And he was still lower than everybody else. Mm-hmm. But that's the way the company was in those days. They mm-hmm. were fair to people and to employees. I thought they were very fair. But... anyways, I started off.
Let's just explore that a little bit further. The Sask Pool was still in the late 70s, very definitely the cooperative, if you will, or the pool.
The
farmers of Saskatchewan.
That's right.
Pooling together. Yeah. And apparently, then the policies that they had established in purchasing, as far as you were concerned, but for the company generally, did the way in which they treated employees and so on, the fairness was.
Yeah, you
fundamental.
You put out quotes. You got you didn't necessarily take the lowest quote because mm-hmm. You wanted quality, service. You know, there were so many things involved in it, and we knew all our suppliers. We knew them all very well, and we had one particular contractor. He bid low on everything, but. He, as we called it, he two-bitted us to death later. He would have all these extras, where the other contractors, they would give you a quote, that would be it. Mm-hmm. At the end of the job, that was what you got. That was the price, unless he came back with something we had done wrong. If we had made a mistake, then we paid for it. But if he made a mistake, that was his problem. That was the policy, and it worked well. Mm-hmm. And but anyways, this guy, he was very, very, very happy that I told him, I said, I'm going to do this once. Don't you set me up again. Because
did he blame anyone for not having the pencil sharpened?
No, he said he didn't know what happened. And he did most of it himself. Yeah. And he said, I don't know what I was thinking that day. He said, when you called me, he said, I should have known something was up. Because he was, he was 55% lower than everybody else or something. Because they all come in at a pretty pretty close, because they know the business and they know how many man hours it takes. And well, they do it by measurements of steel. If you've got so many tons of steel, it's going to take this many men this length of time to put it up or to construct it or what.
The suppliers that you want to use have learned all of that over the years.
Well, they had it down to down to the nickel.
Did you find during the first period of time that you worked that there were changes in the suppliers to that took place?
Oh, yes.
Put a comment on what was going on what happened?
There was a lot of favoritism. That's why he hired me, because I didn't know anybody.
In the business.
In that particular training. Business. Yeah. And there was a lot of things went on that you couldn't prove, but they sure looked awful bad. And I know that predecessors received enormous gifts, and not just in my job, but in the whole company. And there was a lot of I call it skullduggery. That
There are other words for it as well.
But yes, but that's that'll cover close it. To say it could be nice, I do remember after I was there about 6 months, I had a salesman come to see me, and he came in and said, can I talk to you? I said, sure, come on in. He came in, he closed the door. I figured, now, what's this guy up to? And a very nice man. And he said to me, what did we start doing right? I said, what are you talking about? He said, we've had more business from here in the last 6 months than we've had in the last 10 years. And he had excellent service, his products were good, his prices were excellent, and it was, he was being bypassed by my predecessors because, as I think, there was something going on. Because I went out for quotes on everything.
Sure.
And
maybe he hadn't been offering what others were offering.
Well,
and been it frozen out for that reason.
It was the, what do you call it? The perks.
Yes.
That's a good word.
Right.
There was a lot of perks going on. And,
yes.
I didn't have any perks.
Did you have any sense that management at the head office in Regina had come to realize this, and that they were involved in sort of cleaning house here, or was it a bit fortuitous that you came in and that you were hired in your case?
Well,
to
the man that hired me came from Regina, and he replaced a man here that had passed away who was an engineer, and he was sharp. He didn't miss anything, and he knew things were going on, but it was tough to put a stop to it, so I was the stopper.
Did you get a sense that in other areas of the local organization that others were gradually hired? I guess they didn't necessarily fire a lot of people, but when someone died, there was a chance to improve the level of activity.
They did. The level came up quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to change some contracts. They were just terrible. They're just unbelievable that they would do so the vendors would come in and get away with these things. I just couldn't believe it. And I had some people mad at me. Mm-hmm. Of course you get that when that's the job.
Well, it's inevitable if you're going to clean house in this way. If people have got sort of sweetheart deals in return for giving the guy in charge whatever they wanted. Then, of course, the company really needs contracts reestablished on a better basis.
I mean, I told salesmen to get out of my office. They'd come in and
make offers?
Oh, I've been offered everything. And but it's interesting to have salesmen call on you. I've seen every con game, every lying thing. You know, they'd do anything to get a sale.
Because you'd been a salesman.
I'd been a salesman. Don't, you know.
And so you understood that.
Don't kid a kidder, eh? Because I've been there, buddy. I know.
Yeah.
And but
you've been able to make a living without too much in the way of perks.
Oh, well, we never did. The companies I worked for, there wasn't any. Eh?
No.
You know, they didn't even give out a bottle of booze at Christmas, eh? Which was fine with me. I didn't want to. Well, I didn't want to get involved.
That's really clean if there's not even a bottle of booze at Christmas, because I imagine a lot of whiskey has moved in December.
Oh, I've seen cases of it. Cases and cases of it. I know, let's get off this story a bit, but I know another purchasing agent who worked for a big company, not as big as ours, and he told a salesman, was getting near Christmas, and he said to the salesman, "Nice assortment of liqueurs would be nice." You know, liqueurs are very expensive.
And they are indeed.
And an assortment, yes. And this salesman told me, he was a friend of mine, and he told me, he said, "You know what he asked me for?" I said, "I have no idea." He said, "An assortment of liqueurs." I said, "Are you going to get it?" He said, "My boss, I give it to my boss, and he can do whatever he wants. And
ship whatever he wants."
But the thing is, somebody's got to pay for these things. Yeah. Eh? That's the way I looked at it. But anyways, it was...
In your case, the farmers of Saskatchewan would ultimately pay for it.
And they were good to me. It was a good company. Eh? Yeah. And I just couldn't see myself doing anything.
Did you go to Regina at any time?
Oh, yes. I went numerous trips to Regina.
Mm-hmm.
Took courses out there.
Oh, yeah.
And that was it was kind of interesting to go out there. And then the some of the board members would come down here every fall. We'd have a awards night where the 25-year guys get their pins, and the retirees all came. So I met a lot of. In fact, I chauffeured a lot of board members around and
picked them up at the airport.
Oh yeah.
Or did they come in by trade?
They flew in.
They flew in.
Most of them.
Yeah.
But I remember one day I was really busy and the board members were there, and this guy comes in and says, "What do you do here?" And I said, "I'm the purchasing agent." "Oh," he said, "you're the guy that spends my money." I said, "Oh no, I'm the guy that saves you money." And I stood right up to him. Every time he came from then on, he came to visit me. Nicest guy you'd ever want to meet. But he came in here, I guess he thought, "I'm going to show this," as they used to call us, Easterners. but it was an interesting time. I really enjoyed meeting the people, meeting the reps from different companies, and working with the people in the elevator. I mean, I had 200 millwrights to look after and 85 electricians, and everything they wanted, I got for them.
You weren't actually in charge. Responsible for the work that they did, or were you?
No, I wasn't responsible for what they did. I was responsible for what they needed.
Sure.
And the head electrician would send me an order, a requisition, and I in turn had to fill it.
Right.
But after a while, on the electrical side, I put out a contract to all the local electrical firms. And we knew what we needed. We knew what we used. I had lists of everything we used. And I would send it out and say, "Quote me this." And they in turn would. And then it would go for a year, maybe 2 years. And then I'd go out again on it.
Back to the market.
Each head electrician had a book with everything in it that we used. So he just would go down the page and BXY or whatever it was he wanted. And it simplified things because they guaranteed that price for that year.
Mm-hmm.
And their suppliers guaranteed them that price for that year. So, it was very a lucrative contract, because when you got 85 electricians to look after, they go through a lot of fiddly things and big things.
The Sask Pool would rate pretty high amongst the companies in this city. Not as large, I guess, as the paper mills, or was Sasspool actually in competition with Great Lakes, I guess, at the time, and Abitibi were the two. Great Lakes would be the biggest company in town.
It's like in the hydro. Great Lakes got their hydro from Ontario Hydro, where we bought our hydro from Thunder Bay Hydro.
Mm-hmm.
So we were a big user of Thunder Bay Hydro.
And you may well have been the biggest.
We were the biggest
customer for Thunder Bay Hydro. Partly a consequence of the fact that, how many elevators were you operating?
Seven.
You had seven at that time. And of course, they're spotted along the waterfront. Yeah. It's not really easy to run one huge power line in as you can at Great Lakes.
Everyone gets a one power line.
Yeah.
But, you know, when we were making pellets, our electrical bill for a month would be $400,000 for one terminal. But these pellet machines were electrical driven,
and they just ate up the power.
We were selling pellets to Europe in those days, and we just sent boatloads of them over there. Tons and tons and tons of it. And this was all good money, because all you were taking were the screenings.
Yes.
And
mixing them with?
Well, we used to mix them with steam to make them stick together.
Oh, so it was the screenings steamed up and turned into pellets.
Well, they would pulverize them.
Yes.
And the protein in our pellets was exceptional because of what was in them. And then I know that they would send boatloads to France, and France would unload them all. They would even vacuum the boat out.
To get every single bit.
And then they would pulverize ours and mix their stuff in with it, because their protein was so low, but they could make it go further if they put theirs in with ours. So. But tons of
a long established policy of adulteration.
Oh yeah,
but, the animals don't know any better.
No, they was a Canadian or French. They didn't know.
They did that with the Algerian wine as well.
but it was
because the screenings. This is basically weed seeds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
I guess weed seeds are going to be nutritious too.
Well, they work for cows. but we, it was our biggest money maker.
You weren't involved with the selling of those.
No.
You just bought
supplies. And I didn't buy any grain, because the 75,000 farmers, they sent the grain.
Right. How large was the office here in Thunder Bay for Sasspool? How many people worked there? What kind of staff did you have?
I worked out of the engineering office on the corner of Waterford and Dunlop Street. It used to be the Clayton Building. It's across from where UPS is now. There's a long building there.
Hmm. I'll have to check the map to focus that in my own mind. But in any case, you were in that building. How many people worked there?
There were 17 people in there.
17?
Yeah. But they were like engineers, technologists, and office workers, too.
Mm-hmm. Sure, there would have to be the staff.
It's probably the S office.
Yes.
Oh, well, UPS, that UPS on Memorial Avenue, just around the corner there.
Yeah, we were right across the road.
Owen and I know this building pretty well. He knows it much better than I do. I see, so that's where you were working.
And then where the electrical company is, there's a building next to it, and that was a yard for us. And the next building was our warehouse, and I had all my stock in that warehouse.
Mm-hmm.
And I had two trucks on the road, and one man did the mail. This is before faxes, and his job was at 5 o'clock every morning. He made a round of all the elevators and picked up the shipping orders from the day before. He had to have them in the office by 8 o'clock in the morning, and so that they could phone Regina and give them the figures so that they could charge the grain out. And then he would make another round that morning. And he finished at noon, just after lunch.
And Saskatchewan in those days would be, an hour behind?
At least an hour, yeah. So if they got it at 8, they would get it in Regina when they opened.
Yes.
And it was so important because when you're shipping tons and tons of grain, one day difference makes a lot of money difference. Mm-hmm. Eh? You can't the cost, what you would lose if you only sent it once a week, you'd lose money on mm-hmm. it from billing it out.
So this is shipping onto ships?
Onto ships.
Onto the ships. Oh, yes, I can certainly see that. Because I was just wondering about the movement of grain from the prairies. That was all in the hands of the Wheat Board and Grain Commission and so on and so forth. Yeah, and the railways, of course, bringing it in.
Yeah.
But here there were the decisions. So these were the orders from the shipping companies, the vessels here and so on, what was wanted.
Come in
and they that had to be authorized out of Regina then as to...
Well,
which
they built it through Regina.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get a 700-foot ship and it's got a 29-foot draft on it, you put a lot of grain in there.
Yes. Yes, you certainly do.
And, they would ship for hours. They would
be loading a ship.
Yeah.
Yes.
And you have to move the spouts to get the weight even and so forth.
There were other offices that Saskatoon
had. Then we had the 8th floor of the Public Utilities Building.
Here in Port Arthur, if you will. Or
yeah, in Port Arthur. Yeah.
Right.
And we had the whole 8th floor. That's where all the...
And that's where the managers
the locally... The managers and the...
Where everything
the accountants,
was...
accountants.
Mm-hmm.
Accounting people and payroll people and personnel. And they were all up there, which is fine with me. They could stay up there.
Yes, I suppose it's half the city between the two offices.
Right.
Just
you
about
know,
the right.
They were on the phone quite often.
Yes,
but they were still arm's length away.
Mm-hmm. And of course, as long as you're doing your job right, that's just about the right distance.
Yeah, well, I had two mailings a day to the office, and vice versa.
Mm-hmm.
So they everything I did, they got right away. And,
right.
Of course, all the invoices would come down, and I'd have to approve the invoices. But I had a system there that if the invoice matched the purchase order, I didn't have to see it again. But if there was any discrepancies, it came back to me, and then I would correct it from there.
Well, it's part of trusting the people in the organization,
that's
too.
Right.
If they're any good at all, they should be able to follow through.
Well, I had great people. Our accounts payable people were just great. They just on the ball and they went
up on the 8th floor of the Whalen Building again.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
You were referring to communications in two or three connections. When did the fax machine come in at Saspool?
Well, I'm trying to remember the year, Ernie, but anyways, fax machines were just out.
Yes.
And
so it was in the 80s. I date some of these myself. When we were doing the vast and magnificent land project, which you know about pretty well from Eleanor's involvement with it, the ministry had a fax machine, and this was quite a novelty, Ministry of Northern Affairs.
Yeah.
And it seems to me it was in 1987 that fax machines became readily available, and Western Union lost almost half of its business as ticker tape was phased out very largely.
Well, we had a telex machine up in the main office.
Yeah.
But it wasn't that good. We found that it made mistakes. If you were sending part numbers out,
mm-hmm.
you'd get the wrong part. You'd say, this is wrong. And they said, oh, no, this is what your machine said so. Anyways, when it come time to fax machines, and I read up about it, talked to people about it, and so I said, I had to send a request to Regina because this was... something else. I think I bought seven fax machines. I'm sure it's seven. And
I'm guessing it's just before 87 that you were doing that.
And I requested something in the neighborhood of $25,000.
Because they were fairly expensive.
They were expensive in those days. And they weren't that good. Eh?
No.
You know, now to what we have now, now for $100, you can $150, you can get an excellent machine.
Yes.
And I had to say why I needed them,
mm-hmm.
and
that was a new technology.
And But the people in Regina, they were great. Mm-hmm. You know, they sorted away, sent it back, approved. So I went and shopped around for fax machines and bought one and put one in each elevator. I think we only had 5 elevators running in those days, because there was one in my office, one in the main office. So if I bought 7, there was 5 elevators running.
And the great advantage of that was that you could lay a facsimile of your order on a supplier's desk.
Right.
And the numbers were there to be read.
That's
as
right.
As you had approved them.
And the thing I liked about it was quotes came back right away, because when I first started, you sent out a quote, you mailed it out, they got it a day or two later, and then they'd send it back a day or two later. So it was a week before you got your quotes back.
Yes.
With fax machines, I got them back most times the same day, which really simplified everything.
Speeded things up.
They were great. I used it a lot.
Yeah.
But we still sent a hard order out in the mail when we
placed the hard
copy out in the mail. But
I think that's tended to fall away in various contexts. Yeah. People are content with the fax these days, and of course.
But in those days, that fax paper wasn't very good.
Yeah, well, I'm running a Sharp UX256 that I think I bought around 1994. Yes. It's still serving very well, answering machine and all the rest of it. Yeah. But it does have that old paper, that rolled paper, and you end up having to photocopy
if you
want to keep it, because it fades on it.
We found later, going back through files, and it faded all off in your fax.
Yeah. Yeah, this forced you into having a photocopier as well. And a computerization, did that come into your office at some point?
Oh, yeah.
And, of course, into the elevators. You were involved with purchasing those as well?
Well, I found that before the computer, copy machines. We didn't have a copy machine in any elevator. And they would write what they call shunt slips. For each car they push in, you have to make a slip out. And you had to have 7 copies, eh? So the guy would sit there and put carbon paper in, but he'd only do 3 or 4 at a time. And then
he couldn't press through.
Couldn't get, the last one was
illegible, like an old fax.
Right. And then he'd take that out and he'd do another one. And I was down at the elevator one day and I looked at that and I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Oh, I'm doing my shunts." And I said, "Oh." I said, "You make 7 copies." Eh? So anyways, I talked to some people and I said, "I think we should have copy machines down
there." One in each elevator.
They said, "We'll never get those." I said, "Well, I'm not going to ask for 5 of them, because we had them in our office. We had them up in the main office. But I'll work it
one at a time.
And I got copy machines in every elevator.
Yeah, starting with the biggest elevator.
Biggest elevator first, of course. This guy with the 7 shunt slips, he thought he died and went to heaven. Eh?
He just plopped it down
in 7 copies. It took a long time to bring things around. Because things were, you wouldn't believe what I saw down there. When I first went there, they were still doing things from the 30s. Eh? And I just shook my head. This was a $1 million business, and here we are doing things that I remember. I got a phone call from a foreman one day, and he said, "I've been here 19 years, he said, "and that's the first time I ever got a full-length pencil." Because he sent me a note. We kept these stationery supplies in the office, and he sent me a note. He said, "I need some pencils." So I took a box of 6 dozen pencils and put his name on it and threw it in the mail bag. And he phoned me. He said, "That's the first time I ever got a full-length pencil." Because they used to take the pencils up in the main office when the girls got them down to about a 3-inch stub, and they would have to save them. And this guy was running the office, and you wouldn't get a new pencil till you brought your stub in. I couldn't understand.
Because the Sasspool dates from the early 20s, but you were just saying the 30s. You think the Depression determined the business culture of Sasspool for the next 40 years.
Yeah, it did.
50, from the 30s to the 80s.
Yeah. And I said, "Well, what did you get before?" He said, "Oh, we'd get 6 stubs." And I just laughed. I said, "Well, I don't send stub pencils. I don't even keep stub pencils." And then one of the electricians was telling me it, that if you're going down to do a job and you're going to tape something, you'd go to the head electrician and say, I need some electrician's tape. And he'd say, well, give me your pencil. And he'd wrap half a dozen around the pencil. And that's what the guy went down to do the job with. And I couldn't believe it. I said, it's not that expensive. You know, give them a roll.
Yeah.
But they were giving them out by then. But this is what they did. And only two or three years before that, the head electrician would wrap so many turns around the guy's pencil. They were, and yet there was other things that were...
Well, I was going to say, the contrast between a purchasing department that probably cost the farmers money on deals that were made, and then the saving money on pencils and tapes is just a sorry commentary on the company.
Yeah, it was sad.
Yeah.
But it was a great time to be there, to see these things happening.
Because it was changing.
Because it was changing.
For the better.
Yeah. And, of course, I had worked places where we had, we had lots of office supplies. We had, up-to-date equipment.
Yeah, you hadn't talked about computers yet, because that, of course, could be real fun.
Then we came into computers, and the first... The engineer in our office, he was the first one to get a computer. Yeah. And
moved up from his big, heavy calculator to the
real thing. Well, he had that slide thing.
The old slide rule. Oh, yes.
And he had pretty Mickey Mouse, eh?
And, well, I'd use a slide rule in my day just for simple calculations and so on.
He used it
should
for
be part of one's life.
Mm-hmm. But,
yeah, of course, he'd have a more elaborate one for all sorts of things.
Yeah.
But he'd also, I expect, there were calculators that he'd be moving to as well, would he?
Yeah, yeah.
So what did he get
remember what we bought.
Computer.
Well, we bought a number of different computers because we didn't know too much about them.
No.
And we bought different types, and they try them, and then the main office got them, and they tried them in different ones. And
eighth floor Whalen got one. Because I presume that Sasspool will have acquired a big mainframe at some point at company headquarters or not in Regina.
Oh, in Regina had the...
Yeah.
They were into it. But not that soon, eh? They were a long time before they got into it, before the payroll was on. You could tell the payroll forms are all computerized and became computerized.
We were talking, our very first interview was with Roy Lamour, who was... It was CP Rail, wasn't it?
Hmm.
And his the area where he worked was the one that was assigning the individual cars to the elevators. And computerization, in his memory, was taking place in the early 70s, at the beginning of the decade.
Oh, yeah.
And he quoted the person who was beginning the process there, looking around the room and saying, well, there was 20 people working there. It won't be very long. You'll be a lot fewer in number. And Roy said, well, he didn't really understand how that could be, but this fellow knew what he was talking about. Oh, they were down to a handful or fewer within just a few years because, of course, the computer made such an enormous difference.
But we had a learning curve. We had to... I took courses on it, and I wasn't very good at it. Because I took the course, I went for a week, and when I came back, my computer was gone. The one up on the scale floor had calfed out, so they came down, took my computer, and put it up there, and about 9 months later, they came back and gave me a computer, and I said, I don't know what to do with it now. I know how to turn it on. That's about all.
Yeah.
And they said, well, you took the course. I said, that's 9 months ago. I should have been back here working on it.
And the worst of it is that through most of your work years, the ones you're sketching, if you were running a PC, and I presume you would have had PC Microsoft programs, it was DOS that was the operating program and so on.
Yeah.
I'm an Apple user, and of course from the late 80s, things were changing dramatically with the graphical user interface and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
But when is Windows available? Is it 97, or is that a bit earlier than that when Microsoft goes over to the icons on the screen and all the rest of it? That makes it easier to work, whatever the shortcomings of Windows may be.
Yeah.
And that would, and you were retired in 97, so that's...
Yeah. There was no...
Nothing easy.
Nothing easy.
Yeah. I can well imagine.
Yeah.
Well, we're having a great time exploring various. You'd have experiences of the different elevators that Saspool had and what they were like. Saspool bought some of them and built others, all of course before your time. Yeah. But did any of that experience of the origin of an elevator or the nature of it, of each of these terminals, was that part of your experience, what they were like?
In what way? The construction?
Well, the basic structure, perhaps.
No, they were all there when I came.
Yeah, they were all there.
Yeah, in fact, were they all the
same basic? Well, basically, yes, but yeah. Were there differences amongst them that were of interest to you, perhaps in purchasing?
Well, at Current River, we had Pool 4A and 4B. They were two separate elevators, I understand, at one time, and then they joined them. Mm-hmm. And it was owned by another company. And then we had Pool 6, which is that picture there.
The one that's gone.
And
which was very well built, as we all saw when they tried to knock it down.
Oh, yeah. The story the electricians used to tell me about Pool 6, when they would try to drill a hole in it, they would just go through drill bits because the aggregate that was in there was so hard that they couldn't drill through it. They would have to keep pounding. They had to use
compressed air hammer.
Yeah, to drill holes. But the aggregate in there, they said it was a red aggregate, and they said it was just as millions of years old and just as hard as it.
I wonder if it was the best built elevator on the waterfront. It would be really ironic if the city decided to knock down the very best built of the elevators.
Yeah, but it had problems too. It was always wet downstairs. Mm. They had sump pumps running steady because you were right out on the water, really.
Sure.
But
built it perhaps a bit too low then, because it could all have been higher.
They put pilings down.
Yes, of course.
Put one piling on top of the other. They just drove them down for
looking for bedrock.
Yeah. Now at Pool 4, they could only load a boat such a depth because it's all shale down there, mm-hmm. and that you can't dredge it out that well with shale. Yeah. But now at Pool 7, it's all muskeg, and they dredge that one out.
So that was the place where you'd finish off a ship then, I suppose.
Yeah.
Because there's lots of draft there.
Right.
Yeah. So and, seven on in the main group on the intercity waterfront, and then
there was 7A and 7B.
7A and B.
And then we had the old Ogilvy's over by the CP station,
mm-hmm.
and then we had the old Searle elevator out on the reservation there.
Mm-hmm.
But just as I got there, they were just finishing. Up on the river towards Great Lakes, there was a number of small elevators there, and they knocked them all down, but they bought them all. Like just it increased their quotas, the way I was told.
That was your understanding, that the amount that the Canadian Wheat Board would move through Saspool elevators would depend on what their capacity was here at the Lakehead.
Well, they would. I suppose. There'd be a quota for the Lakehead.
Yes.
And each one of those little elevators had a quota. So if you buy them up, you get their quota.
Right.
That's the way I was told.
Yes. Well, I expect that's the truth. It's business like it.
We were taking them down.
Yes.
And
you were on the way to being very definitely the biggest operator on the waterfront here.
Oh, yeah.
No one else would be anywhere close. Manitoba Pool Elevators... was far smaller in terms of capacity here, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And Richardson's?
Richardson's only, they have one or two, and then Manitoba had a couple.
Yes.
P&H was quite small. It was Richardson's.
Okay, well, we've sort of worked past, when did you start working? How long did you work there? Who did you work for? What kind of work did you do? Please describe a typical day. Was there a typical day in your job?
Yes, the first thing I'd do in the morning was sign all the purchase orders for the day before in my mail.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I did it at quitting time, I'd miss something. And first thing in the morning, you're right there.
Fresh as could be.
And And I always went in early so I could get all this done before anybody came in. And then I'd my mail would come in around 8, and then I would get the requisitions from all the terminals and mm-hmm. get to work on those and get stuff sent to the elevator. And, right. and plus many phone calls and many rushes. There was always rushes. Oh, this just broke. I need this right away.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And then we, was the whole day was spent just usually on the phone, purchasing, checking prices, getting mm-hmm. quotes. And then I had the warehouse to look after too, which I had somebody that did it with me, but mm-hmm. it was my responsibility.
How large was your office actually in terms of people? Yourself? An assistant?
I had a junior buyer, and I had a secretary, and
then what the warehouse yeah, that person?
Would be, yeah, and then the two trucks.
Yeah. Very small compliment for the billions that yeah, moved through your office, yeah, I'm sure, which you were authorizing.
A lot of invoices went through for a lot of money.
I could well imagine. When you're buying
it's nice
steel.
Spending other people's money, but, but you know, you got to be careful. I got 75,000 people looking down my throat.
All those farmers.
All those farmers. But everybody thinks they're a purchasing agent. It's unbelievable. Everybody thinks they can do it. Oh, I can do it better than that clown can. Well,
really?
Oh, yeah.
Well, it's being in the position that has other people saying, I could do that, too.
Yeah.
So I don't think I would assert that. I mean, I suppose I could learn it, but
yeah.
but there's a lot to learn.
Oh, yeah, but I'd have superintendents for me. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I'd send a copy of the purchase order down, and they would read it and say, oh, that's far too much to pay for that. One day I had a guy phone me, and he said, I ordered him 6 wheelbarrows, and we had specs on wheelbarrows. It had to be the hardwood frame, it had to have a deep tray on it, it had to have a rubber tire that, I'm trying to think of the name of it, a rounded rubber tire, because if you put a square one on there, as soon as the guy turns it, it tips over.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, this clown phones me from one of the elevators, assistant superintendent. He said, I got the Canadian Tire book here, and I can buy a wheelbarrow for $69. And I said, oh, that's nice. He said, I got your order here, and you're paying $120 for them. I said, that's right. He said, well, why are you doing that? What kind of a purchase? He was really giving it to me. And finally, I took it for a little while, and I said, hey, you don't know what you're talking about. What do you mean? I know a wheelbarrow and a wheelbarrow. So I told him, I said, what's the frame on that one? Because he had the catalog there. He said, it's a pipe frame. And I said, they break. You don't want those. I said, you want a hardwood frame. Mm-hmm. Oh. Then I went on and explained the tires and the trays. Yeah. Their trays are, you know, about so deep, and these trays are this deep. And
sure.
Finally he said, I guess you're right. I said, thanks a lot.
You've just wasted half.
I just wasted 20 minutes of my time straightening this
guy. I'm going to bill you.
but this happens.
Yeah, I can understand. In that sense, people think they can make a better judgment on something.
Right.
But you, of course, said, how many suppliers did Sasspool actually have?
Couldn't tell you.
No, I'm sure. It's a crazy question.
We had
were many of them local?
Oh, most of them were local.
But well, they'd have reps locally.
Or they have, the manufacturer deals through George Hill or Bisco mm-hmm. or Cochran Hardware or one of these.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you get through them.
Oh, so you were able mostly to deal with someone here on...
Pretty well.
On the
on general supplies.
Right.
But, and then, like, we used wire rope cable, and we used miles of cable, and that's expensive. And I'd have 6 or 8 wire rope salesmen call on me. All had the best rope in the world, And most of it was offshore. And if you'd get some of it, it would be really good. But then the next reel you get, as soon as you put some tension on it, it snaps, And it takes a long time. It's dangerous.
Ready to go?
I think so.
Yeah.
You were just alluding to the quality of the wire, the cable that you could buy from various places. Yeah. Consistency of product is absolutely essential, and safety can be involved and whatnot. And that's where the local suppliers, of course, would be involved in providing.
Yeah, but there was one company here that's all they sold was wire rope cable, and we bought most of it from them. And their quality was excellent. It was a little expensive, but if you don't have downtime, you're making money on it. Eh?
Absolutely. Downtime is, in fact, an incredible expense to have.
Yeah.
Would it be a reflection of the way in which Thunder Bay had developed as an industrial place with the terminal elevators and the paper mills, that there were these various suppliers in existence here? You mentioned George Hill and several other companies that had grown up. There was a living to be made.
Oh, yeah.
Providing, representing manufacturers in this city.
Right.
Should be an indication of one of the things that would be distinctive about this city. I remember, was it Jim Armstrong from the Movers once telling me in a context back in the 80s, that you had to come to Thunder Bay, as far west as Thunder Bay, out of Toronto, to find, you know, his company, locally owned moving company. As far as Sault Ste. Marie, they were run by offices out of Toronto.
Right.
And so this, too, may be a reflection of what it was, the isolation of Thunder Bay once upon a time, that these representatives had developed here and made a good living doing that, presumably.
Well, the big companies didn't want to come in here at one time.
Mm-hmm.
But we tried to deal locally if we could, if the price was reasonable.
And the quality was there.
But service, too, means so much. Eh?
Yes.
I mean, I had companies that I could phone an order in at 9 o'clock in the morning that we delivered at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I mean, this is service. Eh?
The ones locally that did stocked a certain amount of of common things.
Yeah, and you know, this makes things easier when you're overhauling equipment, and
it certainly does.
They stock it locally, but we dealt a lot with Northland Machinery and with the Day Company, and they built cleaners, grain cleaners, and they would have these parts on stock. In fact, Northland were even making the cylinders before they had to go to the States to get the cylinders made.
Mm-hmm.
And so they bought the equipment and made them here, which cut the cost down and the delivery.
Sure.
And we would buy, like I'd buy 100 cylinders. They're 2 feet in diameter and 12 feet high. And this was a nice order.
Yeah, it certainly is. What would they be used for?
In the cleaning machines.
In the machines where they were spitting.
Yeah, and I'm trying to remember how many cylinders to a machine. I can't recall it.
Did the cylinders wear out?
Oh yeah. Well, the grain is so hard on equipment, eh?
It's actually sort of corrosive, is it?
On our spouts we had to reline them every year because if there was a bend in the spout. By the end of the year, it would have holes in it from the grain, the friction of the grain. That's why I say I used to buy 40, 50 tons worth of steel every year. And then they came out with a new product. It looks like plastic, but it isn't. I'm trying to think of the name of it. And we used to buy it in sheets, and you can cut it and form it, and you can heat it and form it. And this would last 8 or 10 years.
As against the steel?
Against the steel.
Yeah. Amazing. There are all kinds of plastics, of course, but plastic has the potential to be so far so much better than steel.
Yeah.
Isn't that astonishing?
It was something that we really cut our costs down. Eh?
Of course.
It was expensive to buy, but when you're not replacing it, and we would have, in the wintertime, we used to keep about 100 or 200 grain employees on the millwright gangs to do this work, to replace the spouting, and everything had to be replaced every year.
So there's a good deal of work in the elevators in the wintertime, even if there's no grain moving into ships.
In those days there was, because of I'm trying to think of the word for it, but the abrasiveness of the grain.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember we tried a thing at the hydro plant. They were burning our screenings for a while, and they couldn't believe how their spouts wore out from our grain. And they only use it for a short time. They were flabbergasted that, mm-hmm. that in that short time the abrasiveness.
Yes. And this is the grain itself. I mean, there could be, well, there wouldn't be stones in it or anything of that sort. This is the grain itself.
It's been de-stoned, it's been everything.
Yeah, it's been cleaned out. I've been a farmer's son. I've shoveled the stuff off it enough and so on, and you wouldn't think of individual grain kernels or handfuls or shovelfuls of them as being abrasive material, but they clearly are.
There'd be holes in them.
Yeah.
But then you've got to remember there'd be tons and tons of grain.
Well, yes, of course. You were... Millions of tons moved through this port through the early into the mid-80s, and then things began to slow down. Let's take a look at a few of these questions that give you a chance to construct things. What would you like people to know about the work you did and the places you worked? Stuff that might be an interesting snippet of Peter Barr's testimony on a...
That's a tough one, really.
Or would it be similar to say, what might interest or surprise people most about the work you did?
It would surprise people to know how many more vendors I had than the previous people.
Had people become discouraged?
Before? A lot of people wouldn't even call at the elevators because they knew that so-and-so had it tied up.
So how long did it take for the others to show up? How long did it take for the word to get out?
Well, it doesn't take. I would send quotes out.
Okay.
And they'd be down there like a hungry squirrel. They'd be right there. And like the guy said, what did I do right?
Yes.
You know?
So do you think that your sending out of quotes was a, or asking for quotes is what it comes down to, isn't it?
Yeah.
Requests for proposals.
Yeah.
It was a new thing out of Saskpool then to some extent?
Well, I imagine somebody did it, but I have no idea what it was, because, like I say, this man came down and said, what did I do right?
Yeah. Well,
suppliers.
It's possible that your predecessors, let's put it in the plural here now, having established a number of favorable relationships, shall we say, bother.
No, they didn't.
No.
And I had other suppliers say, how come I'm not getting all the business now? I said, you're getting all you can handle. You know, I had one supplier. He was our pest control man. And the place was running with
vermin.
And I talked to the safety man, and he wasn't unhappy about it. And some of the employees were unhappy about it. So we actually, the safety man found a vendor who was out of Barry. And he came up here, and we talked. And the contract was over with the fellow we had. And so I got in touch with him and said, we won't be renewing your contract. He came down to my office, and boy, he said, what are you doing? He said, I played the game. Oh. He said, I brought the donuts and the coffee and everything down every month. And evidently for years, he would come down with a big box of donuts and cans of coffee and cream and cans of cream. And
at each of the elevators?
And he would put out a couple of traps and... So anyways, we had this man come up from Barrie, and we talked to him, and he spent a week here. He went to every elevator, put 8-10 hours in every one of them, and we could see a difference, eh? So I talked to him, and he for about 6 months, he came up every month. He would drive up to Thunder Bay and spend a week or 10 days, and we weren't paying him any more than we were paying the other guy.
And he wasn't investing in donuts, of course.
But we didn't get any donuts, and I didn't care about donuts.
But he got
did
traps.
The job. We got traps, and he put out, he got rid of pigeons, he got rid of, He didn't shoot them, he didn't kill them or anything. He just made it miserable for them. They wouldn't come back. And in fact, he did move up here because the other elevators were interested in him. and he worked up here for years. I don't know, I think he's retired now, but he came up and established here. And in fact, I drove him around. He was looking for a house. I drove him around a couple of evenings looking for a house, eh? And, yeah. But it was just, these were things that had gone on for years, eh? Yeah. And
I wonder whether Sask Poole inherited some of these relationships when it bought elevators, or whether, or how these things came to be earlier.
Well,
because there must have been slackness somewhere between the farmers, reps in and board in Regina running things and the local operation.
Well, it was up to the local manager here to. Yeah. He was supposed to see these things didn't go on. And when I started here, I worked for a couple of managers who were just super guys. Eh?
Yeah.
And
those earlier ones we're thinking about.
Yes, they were.
Research very nice. Challenges.
They're very, very good people.
Do you want to compliment them on tape, the, no, the good ones?
No, I better not.
Oh, well, if I mean, these were really fine managers, yeah, of the Sask Poole here.
Well, Don Trost was, okay, most of the time I was, yeah, here, and he was...
We've heard his name, and he's sort of in our minds for an interview, yeah, I think, somewhere along the line.
He lives out in B.C. now.
Yeah, right? Well, he'd have to be pursued by someone else, yeah, in our organization.
Yeah. But he was just a terrific guy. You did your job, he didn't bother you. He never bothered me once.
Great way to go.
Once in a while he'd drop in, how's it going? You got any problems? Yeah. I didn't have any problems that, yeah, I couldn't handle. And he'd say, well, you know where I am. You know, and it was a pleasure to have him around, really.
Yeah.
And most of the time I was there, he was the manager. Worked out really, really well. I enjoyed him. Mm-hmm. And you could go and ask him anything. Just a good guy.
Mm-hmm.
And he was fair. He, mm-hmm, was strict in his own way.
He's a manager. He has to be.
He's a manager.
Yeah.
But he was very nice. He was very, very straightforward.
Yeah.
But a lot of these things, I think, had gone on for years. Years and years and years. Yeah. Well, and it just grew from there.
Well, that's why I wonder whether how the Sask Poole operation here at the Lakehead grew. They built some, but I think they bought others.
They bought others. They bought most of them.
And so I'm guessing that they acquired more than just buildings,
yeah,
and structures, and that would be one of the ways in which, yeah, you'd acquire things that you really didn't need as the years passed.
The superintendent looked after most of these things at one time.
Eh? Yes.
So he would do what he wanted to do. And if he had friends, and,
yeah,
that's why I say I didn't know anybody. That's why, right, I got hired.
Yeah, and a town is, Lakehead was isolated enough, and two cities, yeah, jostling each other until, yeah, 1970, that one can imagine a lot of relationships would have developed inevitably,
oh,
in,
yeah,
in the isolation that existed here.
Yeah, there's a lot of stories about those.
Things we won't put on tape.
We won't put on tape.
So that would surprise people. I'm curious, actually, in terms of the changes that came in. Were you given, did you have numbers for what purchasing had cost in previous years that it amounted to, and what you were, you given overall,
no,
figures?
I was never given those.
Yeah, it would be interesting if, on the assumption that Viterra now has all the paperwork for various departments, if they pug onto them, it would, yeah, be interesting to tot up the totals in one year and another. And of, right, course, there's such a lot of variables, the, yeah, amount of grain moving and different amounts of grain wearing on pipes and whatnot.
Yeah.
Was weather a significant factor from year to year? And,
well, you mean western weather?
I was thinking of weather here,
yeah,
in terms,
no,
of...
Not really. Well, the ships might be slow coming in the spring, yeah, or something.
Depending on when breakup occurred.
But if you had a bad crop year, good, then...
What are you most proud of in the work that you did for Sask Poole through these years? Other than cleaning house.
I feel I made good examples for what I did, the way I worked, and I got along well with the staff, mm-hmm. and not just the office staff, but the staff in the terminals,
mm-hmm.
because I would try and help them wherever I could.
Sure.
And evidently that wasn't the way before. The people didn't talk to somebody. It was stupid. I couldn't believe it when I went there. People in the same office wouldn't talk to the other guy. Oh. just infighting and jealousy. A lot of jealousy. Like when I first started, there was two guys in the main office giving me a hard time. And I had them both down in my office one day, and I said, okay,
at the same time?
Yeah. I said, okay, what's the beef? Well, when so-and-so went on holidays, we always did this job for a week or two or whatever it was. I said, I can't help that. I said, you applied, you didn't get it. I applied and I got it. But if you're not happy, if you don't think you were fairly done, I said, let's go and talk to the man in the next office, because he's the guy that hired me, and maybe we can sort this all out. No, they weren't interested. And from then on, they became really good guys. They were good guys. They were ticked off because I got the job.
Yeah.
Confronting
them was the thing to do.
Yeah, and both at once.
Yes, quite.
if you're going to hit them both.
Right.
But and we're still friends. I see them, and we stop and talk.
Sure.
But at the time, they
needed to get that little problem resolved.
Little problems. I like getting little problems out of the road.
Yes.
But as far as the staff in the elevator goes, I got along well with all of them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, and there were some real characters, and funny characters, and silly characters, but we're characters. These are the kind of people you meet.
They did the job.
They did the job, but I don't know how some of them did it. When I first went there.
Want to describe a character or two?
When I first went there, I got some slips in from the elevator, and I saw this guy's name. So I said to Lisa, who was my junior buyer, I said, describe this guy to me. She told me, she described him, and I said, yeah. I went to Pine Street School with him. He was the dumbest kid in Pine Street School. And he was a foreman at the elevator. Eh? And I was just amazed, because he had no personality. He was a dull normal, and I'm being kind. He was just incompetent. But he was there long enough, and somebody pushed him in. That's what happens in the elevator. People get promoted who shouldn't be.
Someone called this once upon a time, well, it was named after him, of course, the Peter Principle.
That's
being promoted to your level of incompetence.
Incompetence.
When you couldn't be moved any higher, it's patently obvious you couldn't even do the job you had.
Yeah. But, and then I met other characters down there. I was warned. The last five or six years I worked at Pool 7. They had closed the office. In fact, we had sold that office. We had moved to the building back of the keg. There's the keg, and then there was the Rollins Donut building, and then there was the next building down towards the lake. We had the ground floor there,
mm-hmm.
and we moved out of the PUC building, and which was another mistake. We moved in there, and then we found out we were paying $100,000 a year rent. I told him, give me 5 years rent and I'll build you a building. Well, you could at that time.
Who'd made that deal?
Bean counters, the accountants.
Yeah.
They wanted everything together.
Regina?
No, here.
No, here. They wanted to do a look over your shoulder easily, then, I take it.
I don't know what, they never bothered me.
Yeah.
And, but
Because they left the Whalen building because it was too expensive?
Well, I really don't. Well, I think the PUC people wanted the 8th floor, because that would be the... It was the price of the building. You saw everything.
That's the top floor.
And I think they were mentioning about moving them, and so we just rented. And we owned part. See, we owned 35% of Robin's Donuts.
Cesspool?
Yeah. And then the building, I don't think they...
No, I guess not.
The building next door that they built was built by Robin's Donuts, so it was hand in hand. And they couldn't get anybody to go in there, and head office thought it would be great if we moved our whole bunch in there. But like I say, we're paying $100,000 a year for this one floor. And so anyways, we got out of there, and we dispersed the departments, and I ended up in the pool 7, which was fine with me. I liked it down there. I had a good bunch of guys that I had hands-on down there.
A lot of stuff you bought went into pool 7, yeah. So there you were.
And I would see things, and that's where I really got my knowledge, was the knowledge I have got of running an elevator. I'd go down to the different departments and see what was going on, and of course, all the millwrights would come in and see me, and electricians. And
how long were you there?
I can't remember. It was 5 or 6 or 7 years.
Around 1990 or 1990,
somewhere in there.
Yeah. And if you stayed on a little longer, you could have become a superintendent or something.
No, I never.
Elevator.
Wouldn't want it. But it was really interesting to be down there.
Yes, and, sort of much more in the midst of the action.
Oh, yeah. And of course, the foreman dumped everything back onto me, like giving out the gloves and all this crap.
Because you were there.
Because I was there. So anyway, they dumped this on me, I put a gross of gloves on my filing cabinet. The guy came in and said, "Can I have a pair of gloves?" "Yeah, try and help yourself." "Can I have a pair for home?" "Sure, go ahead, because they're going to get the men away." So the first little while, we went through a lot of gloves, but after a while, it tapered right off. They knew they could have them anytime they wanted them,
and carry them home.
Yeah, well, they carried them home anyway.
Yeah, well, that's true
and
enough.
We knew this, eh? Yeah. And so I wasn't going to argue with them.
No, I guess not. Well, yeah, but you can't stop.
After the first couple, they
got equipped.
They got equipped. They weren't interested, eh? And things like that went on.
How many tradesmen would you have at Pool 7, roughly? Electricians, for example.
It's roughly 20.
And this would be running around the clock, or would there be 20 of them actually on?
Well, they'd work shift work. Yeah. If the plant was running, they would be there.
And then at least two shifts, then?
At least two. Yes. And if the third shift went on, then they split it further.
Right.
And had to have...
So it required that many electricians to keep an elevator.
Well, there's so many things can
go wrong.
Go wrong, and then they had other things that they would be doing, normal maintenance things, mm-hmm. regardless what shift they were on, and they were a good bunch of guys.
And millwrights?
Seemed to me there was, we wouldn't have 8 or 20 electricians. Probably have about 14. Trying to think now. You got to think back.
Yeah, well, it
we'd
is.
Have 20, we'd have 20 millwrights or more.
Yeah. Well, it's a question about were there 2 or 3 or 5 or is it 20 or more?
Yeah.
So these are very large compliments indeed.
Yeah, they'd be working in all locations of the elevator. It'd take them 20, take them half an hour to walk from the millwright shop to where they're working. Eh?
Yeah.
If you got 4 hours work out of them a day, you did well. Because, you know, they'd come back for coffee another half an hour and back again.
Yeah. These were just the costs of...
Costs of doing business. Eh?
And getting the work done. Eh?
And,
of course, craftsmen have a keen sense of doing these things at the right rate of speed.
Well,
I remember many years ago as a kid working on a school building, at the building of a school in rural Manitoba, and my brother and I were... hired on
as
little helpers in our teens, I guess, and the carpenter asked for something, and I headed off at a run. He's, you never run on a work site, which is, of course, a sound principle in its way.
Yeah.
But it also told me something about the speed at which work would be done,
yeah,
with all due deliberation.
Yeah. Well, this is what it was.
Yeah. The work you did obviously contributed to Canada's success as an international grain trader.
Well, in some way, something must have been right.
Describe any connections you see between your work and the work of farmers growing the grain. Would you want to add to what you, because you've commented on the directors you met, probably other farmers occasionally visited, did they hear?
Oh, yeah, we'd get farmers in all the time. Yeah. They'd be driving through and they'd see the sign and...
I mean, it's my company out there.
That's right. And, of course, we always stopped and every, you know, they were given a tour and you know, they'd be looked after.
Sure.
Which was fine. And, yeah, and they would come, and sometimes they'd stop by where I was. And you know, I'd ask them about their crop, you know, how many bushels you get to the acre. These are things they like to hear.
Yeah. Well, they like to talk about that for sure.
Yeah, yeah, you know.
Depending on the year, of course, somewhat.
Of course, you know, getting 24 bushels the acre, well, that's good.
Yeah.
22 is good.
You know. Love to get 30, but that's rare.
Well, some of them got 30. I don't know what they did.
Yeah. And you got back to Regina, to the headquarters, fairly frequently, you were saying,
well,
actually.
Well, I've been there half a dozen, four or five times, at least.
Over the years?
Yeah.
Not each year?
No.
Right. Yeah, it's quite a building, actually, right downtown Regina.
Yeah.
The last time I saw it, of course, it was being picketed by the office staff who'd been given one of those terrible offers by the latest. In fact, what major changes did you see in your job and the trade over the years? We've talked about some of them in terms of technology changing and so on and so forth, but you also mentioned that it was a great place to work. And you indicated ways in which it could be improved through the 80s. But
it became much more efficient. Mm-hmm. And they changed a lot of the shipping belts that they could move grain faster and easier and things like that that you would see. There's nothing that I could do, but I had to keep the belts in stock.
Sure.
I had 32 miles of belt in the warehouse.
Backup.
Backup.
Yeah. 32 miles.
32 miles. Wouldn't think that.
That's a lot of belts.
It's a lot of belts.
And this would be manufactured, sort of rubberized belt?
Yeah. And different weaves. You had nylon weave and rayon weave. And,
mm-hmm,
and some of them had cotton weave. And depending on the load they carried it was going more to the nylon one because it was stronger, but some of the old elevators still used a cotton belt.
How did these improvements in efficiency come into the elevators? Because you'd be involved eventually in the purchasing decision made, but I suppose you'd have some sense of how an improvement, more efficiency in a particular area, how it would come to the attention of Sask Pool.
We used to have samplers, guys with a little bucket,
right,
and a scoop,
mm-hmm,
and the grain's coming out. Every 20 minutes, they're supposed to take a scoop. Well, they'd go down there and they'd take six scoops at a time and go goof off somewhere. So we put in equipment called an automatic sampler. And the guys up on the scale floor, or no, on the inspection floor, they'd be loading in an area, and he would just hit a button, and a little hatch would open, and he'd get one scoop on his desk. And we were paying that guy $40,000-$50,000 a year to do this. For $50,000, we put an automatic sampler in, and it would work for years.
So, without any wage increase.
No. But these guys screwed it up themselves. And I mean, I watched them on a boat. You know, and I know they're supposed to take 20 minutes because my office ended up watching them right next to the dock.
This was at Pool 7 in the 90s.
Yeah. In fact, the first day I was there, I was busy at my desk, and it was the first boat that came in while I was there, and all of a sudden my office got dark. Because this boat came in, you know, sitting 35 feet out of the water, and it's black, and it just pulls in. All of a sudden, there's no sunlight coming in my window. So I could see things that were going on. But
I bet you were tempted at various times to step out and see how these things actually happened when you're that close to the action.
I would do things like
that. At a certain point in the day, you've got the day's work done, or the half day, or whatever it is.
You know, I'm to a point that I could go and see things.
Yeah. And so the automatic sampler came in.
The automatic sampler. Was it a lot of things like this?
Would your office actually be solicited by the company that had developed that automatic sampler to buy it?
Here in Thunder Bay.
Oh, I see.
At least it was through an agent here at Northland Machinery.
Right.
And they were the agent for them. Maybe they weren't made here, I'm not sure. But they were the agents. They had the...
Of course, all that's required is that one person in one of those elevators decides there's got to be a way to save money doing this automatically. Yeah. And once the thing is developed, it will sell itself to every other elevator in town.
And they, you know, I didn't make the improvements. They made a lot of improvements where they used to come in the morning and there was rows of buttons to start the belts. And then a guy would come in about 7:15, he would go boom, 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 boom. And every belt in the place would run. Now, some of those belts didn't carry any grain all day, but they were running all day. So they put it in. They put it in so that when one belt started, another one would start with it, or shortly after to take, because they knew the grain was going to come down that way. So we saved money by putting this in. I don't really know how they worked it, but it worked.
Yeah. And of course, every belt running is electric power.
Oh yeah,
running too. Yeah, one could imagine that putting in sensor motion detectors that would turn them on when the grain was sighted coming could save you a little bit of money over the years.
And like I say, some belts might not run all day or might not run for a week. We didn't, you know, depending on what bins you're unloading.
Sure. Your 32 miles of belting would last a bit longer.
Was just spares.
Yeah, of course. Well, replacements. It wouldn't be needed as quickly.
Yeah.
Were there other changes that the company itself, did it change significantly while you were?
Later on it did.
In the 90s?
Yeah. We had the president and the two executive officers with him retired. They all retired about the same time, and they put another group of people in there that they weren't as crafty as the three we had. The three we had were very, very cautious, careful managers.
Were they farmers themselves?
Yeah.
Yeah. Who moved up to this, and it became a full-time job for them. Were there ones who succeeded them also farmers? Or?
No, I don't think so.
No. So they.
Yeah. And they were all Baptists. These three guys were all Baptists.
The ones who retired?
Yeah. And they were very fair, but they were very smart. They were very cautious, Very cautious.
Not out of the same church, I don't suppose.
I don't think so.
No.
But it just happened that they all were.
And the ones who replaced them?
Were clowns. Yeah. And, the one president that we had, he came down here one time and he called a management meeting, but he only wanted to speak to people under 35. He didn't want to speak anybody over 40, he had no part of, because we were the outgoing guys.
Yeah. How old was he himself?
Oh, he was in his 30s.
I see.
And he just wanted the new guys and, you know, what we're going to do. We're going to set this company on its ear and all this crap. Never did. Yeah. Lost money, just went broke.
Now, was he the president who took Sask Pool to Bay Street and got it publicly listed. Did that happen while you were...
Yeah, I was there. I was just when I was leaving. Eh?
Yeah.
In fact, they pressured all the management people here to buy shares. Eh? I said, I'm retiring in, I don't know, 2 years or something. I said, I don't want any.
No.
But they were selling the shares. They were $14 for a share, and they were selling them to the staff for $12. I talked to a couple of foremen years later, and they were down to about $3 and change.
Yeah.
I said, that was a good investment.
They'd been taken, even at the $2 saving.
Yeah,
yeah, you got to get stock options really low, and then choose the time to buy.
That's right. But, you know, this was a way of life. But this guy was, he made so many errors, and we lost so much money. And,
Well, it's from that point in the late 90s that Sasspool has ground its way downward to the, well, we won't get into the mergers stories. That's after your time, and we don't have the detail. But
well, he was the guy, he bought some old elevators in Manitoba and made fish farms out of them.
Oh, was that another adventure?
That didn't work, and we lost piles of money on that.
How did the investment in Robin's Donuts develop? Because the company began locally, of course.
Yes.
The entrepreneurs, if you will, were local people.
And Sasspool came to them and they wanted to buy our flour.
Mm-hmm.
And it ended up that Sasspool supplied them with all their supplies, their sugars, everything. And they formed another company.
Sasspool did.
Yeah.
To do this. Yeah, because you weren't in the flour milling business, were you?
Well, we had some places that made flour somewhere. I don't know where.
Mills that belonged to Sasspool?
Yeah.
Before?
Well, Ogilvy's, we bought Robin Hood from Ogilvy's.
Okay, well, sure.
At one time.
Yes.
And the bagging the stuff was all there, and they could, they could do it.
Yes.
But they had some elevators that produced flour. And but they bought all the supplies. Robin's Donuts bought everything from, I'm trying to think, it just had three letters for a name, SC something or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they just...
Well, I suppose that was probably a sound enough decision. It probably made Sasspool some more money.
Oh, yeah. Well, 35%. At that time, Robin's Donuts was very popular.
Yes. Yes, it was the time when it was
35%.
Going strong.
Yeah.
Were there other changes that would be useful to talk about?
I can't think of any at the moment.
What about other challenges facing you? Was there anything you'd want to put under that heading in your job?
Challenges?
No. Like guys who thought they should have had the job. And
that was just at the beginning.
And suppliers who...
Well, there were a lot of suppliers who thought... Who wanted you in their pocket, as they called. That was one of the expressions.
They actually used it.
Oh, yeah. Well, they wouldn't use it to me, but that's what they wanted. Eh?
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of purchasing people were in people's pocket. Like Great Lakes was great for it. Eh? And, well, I had one vendor. He offered me a month in Florida. He had a condo down there. And I said, I'm not interested. Oh, he said, it won't cost you anything. He says, I'll even pay your airfare. And I said, I'm not going. Forget it. And he was very annoyed. He said, you're really hard to get along with. And I said, but don't we get stuffed, eh? Anyways, the guys from Great Lakes all went down there. Oh, it was a, and anyways, he was audited, federal audit. And he said, what's this Florida business? So I have a condo down there for my guests. Oh, he said, do people use it? Oh, yeah. Fine, you'll have to send them a T5 slip. And all these guys at Great Lakes got a T5 slip. He sold it immediately.
Benefits enjoyed.
Yes.
In lieu of income or whatever.
Things like that.
Yeah.
There was offers all the time. Another guy called me one day and he said, I got something for you. And I figured, oh. So I went over and he had a metal fireplace. Eh? He said, wouldn't that look good in your camp? I said, no. I said, do you know how much that thing weighs? I said, I'm not interested. Well, I said, put it in the corner of your camp. He said, it'd be beautiful. I said, I'd have to put a concrete base down, and I said, I'm not interested. I've got a wood stove now. What do I want that for? He said, don't worry about installing it. He said, I'll get some of our Italian friends down and put it in for you.
We'll lay some brick.
They'll do everything. But I said, I'm not interested. And he really got annoyed with me. This happened more times than you can believe.
Yeah. Well, I'll leave listeners sometime to draw the moral. I'm tempted to moral observations in general, but I'll sell.
But it just went on and on. Yeah. I know one elevator superintendent went to Hawaii 17 years in a row with a local supplier. Him and his wife went with the supplier and his wife for 17 years in a row to Honolulu.
Wow.
But he bought everything from
them. Oh, yes, I can imagine.
Everything
a captive arrangement.
Everything that elevator needed went to that one supplier. I mean, he'd phone up and say, give me 25 cases of toilet paper. This guy didn't sell toilet paper, but he'd phone the toilet paper guy up, order 25 rolls, send his truck down to get it, add 25% or whatever onto it, and take it to the elevator.
There's a certain measure of laziness, I suppose. Is the elevator that was doing this didn't have a purchasing department? Or was this
the superintendent was the purchasing
department. Yeah, clearly.
So everything that was needed went to this one.
Whoever owned the elevator could have saved money by having a good purchasing.
But it went all to the one vendor.
Yeah.
And I didn't know anything about it until we were at a Jeeps. Have you heard what Jeeps are? Grain processors.
Yeah.
We went to a Jeeps thing one night, and we were invited back to this house after the thing. And this particular superintendent's wife got half in the bag, and she was telling my wife and I about 17 years we've been going to Florida or to Honolulu. And then her husband came over and said, shut up. Then I really knew it was a game, eh?
Yeah. You won't tell us which elevator this was, I know.
No, I won't. I can't.
Damn! I don't suppose these are the most vivid memories of your job.
No.
But are there vivid ones that you might want to leave a record of?
When I first went to SAS Pool, the fellow who hired me said, you don't have to worry about buying dies, because each pellet machine has a die in it about this big around. And about this thick.
Well, this is a metal die, not a color.
No, it's a
right.
die. It's
yeah.
a,
yes.
And the screenings are pushed through this to form the pellet.
Yeah.
And he said, I've got all arranged with a supplier in Winnipeg, and you just send them down automatically. I said, okay. So I was there about 4 or 5 months, and I phoned this guy up and said, send me four dies down. He said, oh, they haven't got any more. I said, well, you got a contract. He said, oh, well, you took all that was on the contract, which I didn't know. And I said, well, why haven't you got any more? He said, they're sitting on a dock in Singapore. I said, that's not doing me any good. He said, no. He said, but that's where they are. So I had to scurry around and find another company that made dye. I found one down in Iowa, and who had a distributor here, and this distributor here worked with me. In fact, he sent his truck to Minneapolis. The people in Iowa sent their truck to Minneapolis, and I got the dyes within X many days. But I thought I was going to get fired, because when the pellet plant's down, that's the moneymaker.
Yes.
And I never ran out of dyes again.
No. What had gone wrong?
Well, he had contracted for 30 dyes.
And no one had pointed out that
nobody pointed this out to me.
The chap who told you not to worry about them
I didn't look it up. I just phoned Sullivan, Strong, Scott in Winnipeg, and they would send them down.
Yes.
And they're heavy, either. They're
solid steel or solid, with holes in them.
Yeah, and some of them are stainless steel.
Mm-hmm.
And anyways, I thought I was done for. That's the only time I sweated it out, eh? Till I got them in here. But the guy,
you looked over every contract after that, I'm sure. Came in first thing in the morning to check.
The guy is in the pellet plant. I told him what happened, and they're good guys, eh? They took all the old ones back and ran them for a little bit more, eh?
Yeah.
To get another day out of them, another few hours out of them. And it's a lot of work to change them, maybe, because you've got to use a
machine.
You've got to block and tackle just to lift them in and out.
I can imagine.
But that was the scariest week of my...
The most vivid memory of your job.
Very vivid, I'll tell you. I thought I was in trouble.
So. When you survived.
Yeah.
In your mind, what were the most important events that happened in the workplace during your career?
Most important. I guess modernizing would be the... I did some modernizing, but the company itself modernized, and they came forward a long way. You can't believe how much more efficient they became, and that was something to remember. And I was there; I was part of it,
Sure.
And it was my job to find these things. And
yes.
I must tell you one story about finding things. We had a certain fuse that we used at Pool 4. It was an old machine, but we still used it. And they came and said, I need these fuses. So I phoned here and there and everywhere. I ended up in California talking to a guy there. He said, no, he said, we haven't made those in 10, 15 years, he said. So he said, there's a guy in Pennsylvania makes them. I said, oh, whereabouts? He said, Indiana, Pennsylvania. Well, I lived there for a year, so...
There is an Indiana, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, so I scrounged around and got his name, and I phoned him, and I thought, how am I going to? I need these right away. How am I going to talk this guy into it? Anyways, I'm talking to him, and he said, "Whereabouts are you?" You know how they talk funny down there. And I said, "I'm 200 miles north of Duluth, Minnesota." That's the only way they could understand it. So he said, "Yeah." He said, "I got some of them on the shelf." I said, "Can you send me X many?" Forget how many, and he said, "Yeah, I guess I could." He said, and then we got talking a little bit more, and I said, "Where do you live?" And he said, "Well, I live in Plumville." "Oh," he said, "I got a friend in Plumville, a guy I fished with up here, and he would come up here every year. We'd go fishing." I told him his name. "Oh," he said, "a friend of mine." "Oh," I said, "a friend of mine too." So, anyways, the next day they were on the UPS coming up here, I said to him, "Well, if you send them," I said, "I'll get them from UPS," and I said, "I'll have a check in the mail the next day." And he said, "Well, if you're a friend of Milo's," he said, "I'm sure you will." And they were here, UPS.
Yeah.
And I sent them through all the stuff I sent through Fort Frances. If you send it to Toronto, it can sit there for weeks before it gets through customs.
I see.
But if you send it to Fort Frances, Rainy River, in that area,
they're just not that busy there.
Well, it goes through that day,
yeah.
Because UPS has a deal with them,
mm-hmm.
that customs. So, anyways, that's just one little story.
Yes, and these are marvelous stories. If I wasted time telling my FedEx story, my Texas friend in the Dallas area, who says when we're on the telephone around 8 in the evening here, I guess they're of course an hour later or earlier because of they're in central time down there, and he says, I want you to have this, whatever it was. He said, I'll get it to you. I said, it's FedEx. He said, you'll have it tomorrow afternoon. I said, what do you mean you'll have it tomorrow afternoon? He says, they haven't closed down here yet. I'll just run it down there. And
amazing.
And of course, at 1 o'clock or whatever, the truck rolled up here at the house. And
it's there.
Yeah. And of course, I began thinking about, Dallas to Memphis, I think, is their great hub in the U.N., Tennessee. And another plane flying in the night to Toronto and from Toronto to here. I mean, it's just three legs, and if they're flying through the night, it's not difficult to get it here by early afternoon. But you need that kind of system. It really
works.
Yes.
I had another time I needed a motor. And there's none in Canada, none in North America. This thing was made in Sweden. And we put this system in, we didn't have a spare. So I phoned up and I said, I need this motor. "Oh, okay, we'll put it on the next boat." I said, "No, you'll put it on the next airplane." He said, "That's going to cost you a fortune." I said, "I don't care. If I lose three cars, it would be $1,500 to fly it. If I lose three boxcars, I've lost $1,500. But if I lose 50 boxcars, I've lost $25,000.
Yeah.
So I said, "Put it on the next plane." Put it on the next plane. But sometimes you got to use your own discretion.
Yes.
And And it sat in the warehouse, is probably still sitting there. We never used it, but you don't know.
Did you have a lot of redundancy, you know, planned redundancy in this way? Backup engine, the belting you mentioned, the motors?
Well, we had some,
So you just needed to be sure that
what you had
keep
to
things
have,
moving, that the grain but, keeps
but I,
flowing.
But I would write so much off every year, and if things were redundant, they never did it. And when I got there, the warehouse was jammed with stuff. I'd say, what's this for? Oh, he said, we haven't had that machine for 20 years. I said, well, why are the parts still here? We didn't know how to get rid of them.
So what would you do with that?
Well,
this was steel, I suppose.
I would write it off and just put it in the
scrap. For scrapping?
Yeah. But they didn't know how to write it off. And I'd worked at places, we wrote so much off every year. You have to.
It's not actually a very complicated matter, I guess.
No, it isn't. It's just, just bookkeeping, eh?
Yes.
I call it bookkeeping. They call it accounting now.
Yes. Really. Yeah. Have some letters behind their names and don't necessarily do a better job.
When I took bookkeeping, it was bookkeeping. Yeah, two columns, in and out. That was it.
Oh, really simple. Yeah, you get an accountant to set books up for you, and you end up with about 10 or 12 columns, most of which you'll never use.
Never use,
You know, I had this small consulting business, and I had an accountant set mine up, and I find I use about four of them. I need all four of the ones I use, but they're there, so I use those. The other page, I just don't use at all. Let me see. Do you think it's a good idea, it's important to preserve share Thunder Bay's grain trade history?
I think it should have been done years ago. Right? Yeah. There's so much history down here.
Yeah.
Like the first boat they loaded it from, which I can't remember, the elevator.
Back in 1880.
Yeah, they did it with wheelbarrows.
Yes.
And they had to wheel it from there down to the CPR dock because they couldn't get into. These are things that...
There's a lot of history down there that... there's the sources exist.
Yeah.
For what... Where there aren't sources, of course, it's just completely gone. The memories are gone and so
That's
on.
Right.
But there are a lot of sources to be explored. And you're right. There's a lot of history that could be written.
Yeah.
That's what it comes
should
down to.
Should have been kept.
And
In fact,
should have been done.
We asked the terminal manager, 15, 20 years ago when he was here, the manager for all the terminals from Sass Pool, we said, why don't you have a history down there? Well, that's up to the Jeeps. He just passed it off. Elner and I asked him at a party one night, he said, and of course she's interested in history. She said, things are going to move so doing this is great.
Yes. Would Pool 6 have been a good elevator to maintain, to keep standing, to use as a historic site or not?
It could have been, I think. But they said it was too costly to
it wouldn't be cheap.
No.
It would cost a certain amount to do
but,
that.
But we suggested, some of us, that they keep it running and spot a couple, when the tourists are there, spot a couple of cars in and unload them and clean the grain and, how people see how it was done, but they weren't interested.
Of course, by that time, this president was more interested in selling stock on Bay Street than he was in doing anything in Thunder Bay.
Yeah.
Well, that just about wraps it up. Are there any questions that we might have asked which you could still answer now?
I think I've talked enough this afternoon.
Well, you've told us an awful lot of very interesting things, Peter, and I think I was saying something to Owen about what we might have in prospect here, and I think Peter's delivered.
He has indeed.
Right. You don't have memorabilia from your employment there?